So this will be our last session for today. We'll start with a discussion. I'd like to end with a short period of meditation, so we end on a point of quiet. But now would be a time to explore any questions or issues that you have. Who would like to start? Yes. You can't think that through. I didn't explain it clearly enough, obviously. So, no, they're not. No, there are four terms, four words in Pali that have the same definition. Nirvana, the unconditioned, the deathless, and fully knowing or embracing. If the four words have the same definition, they are synonyms. They mean the same thing. They're different ways of saying the same thing. So when we talk of nirvana, let's just say non-reactivity. I think it's probably better to say non-reactivity, actually, than nirvana. Nirvana carries a lot of Buddhist baggage with it. So to avoid that, we can just say non-reactivity. Another way of saying non-reactivity is to say the deathless. Now, this is a little bit complicated because we have to remember that the term the deathless was already in use at the Buddha's time. In other words, it was a word that we find in the Upanishads, the early Upanishads, and when the in the record of the Buddha's own renunciation, he says, I will seek the deathless. I'm going in quest of the deathless. So the deathless kind of meant, at his time, something like salvation. And in Hinduism, the word is used to mean Unsterblichkeit, immortality. And if you read a translation of the Upanishads, you won't find the deathless in English. You'll find immortality, Unsterblichkeit. Now, clearly what the Buddha does, as he does on many occasions, is he takes a word that has a commonly accepted meaning and gives it another twist. So for him, he's not proposing immortality. He doesn't hold any notion of some soul or self that will survive death and live forever. So what does he mean? I think it seems fairly obvious, since he defines amata, deathless, as absence of greed, absence of hatred, absence of delusion, that it refers to a non-reactive mind. A non-reactive mind is one that is freed from the forces of death. It's freed from the grip of Mara, which also means death. So a non-reactive mind is a mind that is alive. That's the implication. It's a frame of mind that is not constricted by greed, hatred, delusion, that are a kind of inner death. So the deathless means a non-reactive mind, one that is no longer held captive by reactivity, is no longer, as it were, killed by reactivity. Okay, is that clear? The unconditioned, again, it's asankata, and I suspect, although I don't have hard evidence for this, that this term too would have been something equivalent to Brahman. We say that with God in the West. Aristotle talks of God as the unmoved mover. In other words, this power, this force, whatever, that is not in itself conditioned, but conditions everything else. So unconditioned sounds very much like something close to an impersonal God. Again, the Buddha takes this term and he gives it a new twist. For him, it's not the unconditioned in some sense of a metaphysical absolute. And some Buddhists do look at it that way. It's quite common. The unconditioned becomes more or less interchangeable with something like Brahman. Something similar. The way the Buddha defines it, and he does this in the a series of texts called the Asankata Samyutta, the connected discourses on the unconditioned. He says, monks, I will teach you the unconditioned. What is the unconditioned? It is the absence of greed, the absence of hatred, the absence of delusion. And then he says, and I will teach you the way to the unconditioned. And what is that way? It is mindfulness of the body. And that's, of course, the first step in the various mindfulnesses and so on that lead to Nibbana. So not only does he take the unconditioned to mean unconditioned by greed and hatred and delusion, which is, again, a non-reactive mind, one that is not conditioned by attachment, aversion, egoism, strong sense of self, and so on. But that unconditioned mind is one that we can reach by paying closer attention to the body. Now, this, in many ways, is going directly against the dominant thinking of Brahmanic culture. It's important that for me it's important, as a scholar, to see these terms as having a meaning within the Buddha's world that he then subverts. He turns on its head. He does the same with karma, he does the same with dharma. And that, I think, is an indication of the radicality of what the Buddha's doing. He's turning the world upside down in some ways. And not only in terms of religion and philosophy, he's also responding to a world that is literally being turned upside down. The historical moment in which the Buddha lives in the 5th century BC in India, North India, is a period of enormous change. Political change, economic change, social change, religious change. And he is a figure who is actually addressing people who are undergoing this turmoil on all levels. And he is providing, I feel, a strategy, a practice that enables people to live with this turmoil, to live with these changes, and to learn how to basically be at ease with themselves, to be alone. We're going to talk about this tomorrow. But does that sort of clarify this? The fourth term, parinya, fully knowing, again, it means to know something in a non-reactive way, to experience the world, to embrace the world, without the agenda of my wants and my dislikes and my interests being uppermost. So again, it's the same thing. Yes. Uh-huh. 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 And sorry, the as well as, yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think it's very, very helpful if we're going to pursue a practice of Buddhism to experience it as it is lived in Buddhist countries. It's not always what you expect. you might have some romantic idea of Buddhism that is sometimes reinforced by the local Buddhist center in Frankfurt somewhere, which is able to exist as a little bubble in the midst of the Western world, and it's a perfect little example of everything good about Buddhism. But when you go to a Buddhist country, you find that Buddhism is much more like Christianity is here. And in fact, this was very striking when I lived in Korea. I spent 4 years living in a monastery in Korea. Korea is a country in which Buddhism has been established for 1,500 years. And it has developed to the point that it is so well, it's so much part of Korean culture that it's somehow lost its vitality in many ways. It's just become a kind of a place, Buddhist temples and monasteries are largely preoccupied with doing rituals and ceremonies, offering some help to the local people, and a few of the monks meditate, but not that many. And that's true in most Buddhist countries. Most of the monks and the priests will be doing pastoral work of some kind or another, which is important work. You see, the other thing we don't notice here in the West when we think about Buddhism is that it's not just about going to the center and meditating and studying texts. Very few lay Buddhists in Asia do that. They're not interested in those things, or it's never really occurred to them. Or they might have even been dissuaded by the monks. This is too difficult, this is for the monks. And so what we meet in Asia is it's remarkably similar to walking into a Catholic church in Italy somewhere, and there's a few old ladies lighting candles, and there's a priest there taking confessions, and there's kids running up and down the aisles, and it's just ordinary life. And Buddhism is just ordinary life in these temples and things, and I like that. I like the fact that it's not some precious little bubble of enlightenment surrounded by effectively disinterest in the West. But it's integrated into the society at all levels and in all ways. But as much as that is useful to observe, on the other hand, I think it's also something we need to question. You know, is this really what the Buddha was interested in? Temples that will do rituals and make happy, you know, make ceremonies when you die and so forth and so on. And of course we also see, particularly of Burma and Sri Lanka, the monks are totally involved in politics. And the thing that really distresses me is the extent to which they are promoting nationalist and racist agendas. The persecution of the Rohingya people in Burma is largely encouraged by the senior monks. The war against the Tamils in Sri Lanka, likewise, it was heavily promoted by the senior monks. Now, to me, this is a long, long way from what Gautama would have had in mind. He didn't see the Dharma as a kind of, as a vehicle for ethnic identity. He saw it as a universal teaching for all beings. So we can see how, again, when institutions become consolidated, when the religion becomes somehow an arm, the moral arm of the state, then it effectively becomes corrupted. And I don't think this is a surprising thing to say. We see it in all organized religions. They, especially if they become established churches, they tend to become compromised deeply by the demands of the state. So yes, I think the Dharma in the West will almost certainly be a lay movement, but to be quite honest, I'm not sure that this language of lay monk is of much use anymore either. I'd like to somehow leave that particular distinction behind and to think really in terms of practitioners, people who practice the Dharma, and it doesn't matter what walk of life they are from, whether they're professional monks or whether they're people living in the world, what in a sense keeps the community together is a shared commitment to the Dharma, to the practice, to the philosophy, to a contemplative life, to an ethical life. That's what really matters. And what forms that will assume, we don't know. But frankly, I'm not interested in creating another Buddhist church, as we mentioned this morning. But exactly what kind of community might emerge, I think it's too early to say. We don't know. I think you had your hand up first, then you, Michael. Yes? Yes, du kannst, ja. Ich habe genau dieselbe Problem mit Deutsch. Du bitte. Ach gut. The last bit, eine Vergangenes. Oh, a past life, right. Yeah. Yeah, it's usually either a witch, ein Hexin. Yeah, it's either a Hexin or a princess, usually. It's unlikely she would be a baker's assistant. Yes. See? Exactly. Feel mad. and quotes around her, yeah. Well, let's try to look at this. I mean, the best answer would be for you to read my book, Jenseits des Buddhismus. Hat schon gelesen. And you still think it's just reducible to a mindfulness technique? Ah, that's okay. So how do I answer my dojo lighter in? The former witch. Well, in my book After Buddhism, I identify four principal themes that constitute the Dharma. The principle of conditionality, the practice of the four tasks, the perspective of mindfulness as a meditation perspective, and the emphasis on self-reliance. Now, all of those things, particularly the four tasks, can be fleshed out into what constitutes the framework for a community and for a culture. Rather than a religion, I like to think of a secular dharma as creating the foundations for a culture. I think the practice of mindfulness is central to this. That is absolutely true. But I don't feel that simply to practice mindfulness is in and of itself enough. It's a useful a strategy, it's a useful methodology, both for dealing with specific problems in life and perhaps for looking at some of the larger issues of human experience. But in and of itself is not enough. There needs to be a philosophical framework, which I feel quite clearly there is. It's a pragmatism, it's a skepticism, and there needs to be a contemplative practice, which is more than just doing mindfulness. It also includes other cultivation of other spiritual qualities, like collectedness, like loving kindness, and compassion, and all of these things. And it is very much about, as I said, it's very much about creating a framework for a community or a culture. And none of that, all of that is rooted in the earliest texts that we find that have come down to us. And we find that many of these ideas are further developed in Zen, for example, and other traditions. But what we don't really need is elements that are drawn from the cosmology and metaphysics of ancient India. That's basically what a secular dharma is, the same dharma that everybody else practices, or at least what I believe the Buddha taught, but without having to articulate that in the language of ancient India, which is karma, rebirth, different realms of existence, spirits and gods floating around all over the place, magical thinking of different kinds. And you'll find a lot of contemporary Buddhists who are, as you say, Western educated, often professional people, will still feel that those ideas are important to them. Now, and I'm not in the business of denying them that. That's not my. I don't have an issue with that. The important thing for me is not whether or not reincarnation is true, but whether or not a belief in reincarnation helps you flourish more fully as a person. If it does, then that's fine. I don't have an issue with it. But the problem is it often becomes a consolatory belief that seems to enable you no longer to have to worry about death. It's a way of denying death in a quite literal way. You don't really die. You'll get reborn as something, like a witch, for example. And that's obviously better than not being reborn at all. So all of those things, I think we can quite politely, not reject, but simply we don't need to talk and think that way anymore. And that means we don't need to make a kind of campaign against people who still believe those things. That's not really, I have no interest in that at all. And if those beliefs mean something deeply for a person, that's fine. I would never say these things if I go to Korea and I'm with my Korean Buddhist friends in a monastery. I respect what they do, and they do so with good faith and wholehearted commitment, and these myths and beliefs are very real for them, and they're very important in their lives. And I have no interest at all in questioning that for them. But as a Westerner, as someone who's not brought up in that way of thinking, way of seeing the world, I always find it a little bit artificial that we struggle to somehow hold on to these kinds of ways of thinking. I did that for many years too. For my first years as a Buddhist monk, I strove very, very hard to believe in rebirth, karma, different realms, everything. I really struggled with this because I was told, if you don't believe in these things, there's no way that you can then attain enlightenment or liberation. That these are necessary elements of the Dharma. If you reject them, you've rejected the Dharma as a whole. And I have people, I know, for example, the fellow I just spoke about who was in the island on Taiwan translating the Pali Canon. He is completely against what we're doing here. For him, secular Buddhism is a terrible thing. And he believes in reincarnation a lot. And he's a highly educated man. He's a wonderful person. I get on with him personally very well. But he cannot tolerate the idea that you could practice the Dharma without believing those things. So I respect his choice. If you're interested, actually, on YouTube, there is a debate between me and him you can watch on the topic of rebirth. There's a couple of debates I've done with Australian monks about this. But frankly, these questions just go round and round in circles. They don't go anywhere. You can't prove or disprove reincarnation. Yeah. Oh, sorry. No, Michael had his hand up. Yes. In which way?
The first part is clear. It's clearly visible. Well, it's always around. Mm-hmm. You just have to try to look at it. But the second part...
Hard to see, yeah.
Hard to see. I think I heard another talk already in the book. Shouldn't it be correctly hard to stand to see?
Ah, yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's one meaning, yeah. I think hard to see in the sense that it is actually difficult to recognize the fact that we can be non-reactive and to acknowledge that that's effectively the nibbanic condition. But it's also hard to see in the sense that it's hard to bear. Because again, this is not really spoken about much, but when you, one of the functions of having a strong ego and living one's life trying to get what you want and get rid of what you don't like and being important and all these things, I think one of the reasons that we're so strongly conditioned to do that is because it somehow anesthetizes us. It serves as a kind of a drug, and it's a drug that kind of makes us anesthetized to the suffering of the world. We're totally locked. You understand? You know what an anesthetic is? Anesthetize. It makes us betäuben, whatever that means. Yeah, it makes us betäuben. And I think people often experience this on retreats, for example, when you let go of some of these habits, when you let yourself just, we would say, you open your mind and open your heart. You just quieten down, you get still, and this very often leads to a kind of vulnerability, a kind of openness and sensitivity that can be quite painful, actually, both regarding yourself, but also regarding others. And I find that when the mind becomes more contemplative and more still, we become much more sensitized to the suffering and pain of others. And even more so sometimes with some of the awful things that go on in the world. And it can be quite unsettling and difficult to really hold that. We run away. We'd rather have something to distract us, as it were. So that, I think, is an important dimension of this practice. That it does require a willingness to face up to reality, really. and the painful, almost infinite dukkha that is present in the world. So yeah, I would say hard to see, and that's it. It's difficult to see. It's difficult to look at that. It's difficult to watch starving children in Africa on the television news, and yet we become somehow anesthetized to it. It's just more images on a screen. But if we were to stop our reactive habits, quieten down and look, it would be hard to bear. Yes? Yeah, sure. My mother spent the last 10 years of her life in a home for old people, and she was declining constantly and was suffering a great deal. But she was not a believer. She couldn't, she'd never, her father had rejected Christianity when she was a girl. And so she'd grown up as a humanist and so on. And she was very aware that the happiest people in the care home were the religious people. She lived in a rural part of England, Shropshire, and most of the other residents were farmers and people living on the land. She was educated from London, middle class, educated. And she envied the peace of mind of these elderly women and men in the home who were completely certain that death was just the entry into eternal life, where they would meet all of their friends again in heaven, and so forth. So clearly, yes, the belief in rebirth is not just a metaphysical thing that you can argue about. That's actually, in some ways, missing the point. The point is that it serves to provide an enormous sense of consolation for those who are able to believe in it. And I suspect that's why these ideas are so popular, is because they actually have an important social function. And part of the crisis we have in a secular society is that we have nothing to replace them. And consequently, there is really little, the question then, therefore, how do we die, takes on a whole other dimension. Now, I have thought about this. Clearly, I wouldn't say the same as your Buddhist monk friend said, but I would actually take from my own practice of particularly mindfulness, but also in this respect, my training in Zen, which has been primarily about approaching life as a question, not as a set of facts, but always to cultivate a sense of deep curiosity and wonder about the fact that we're here at all. That is the frame of mind in which I would seek to approach death. That is the frame of mind I would seek to encourage if I were accompanying, or a begleiter would be a companion or something of those dying, would be to really keep in one's mind that death is essentially the most mysterious thing about life. That life and death are not they're not opposites. They're not life good, death bad. But existentially and experientially, life is a going towards death. Zur Todesein, as Heidegger put it. And I think this is again very much the kind of awareness one has through doing awareness meditation, by focusing again and again and again on impermanence, on the tragic dimension of life, and being able to say fundamentally, yes, this is how things work. This is how it works. And me, I am no different. I'm also a transient creature who is, with every breath, becoming that much closer to death. And that is my end. And rather than rejecting death, in other words, believing that it's just a kind of a, sort of a staging post or something else, but to take it in uttermost seriousness, that to me is a profound affirmation of life. In that sense, if I can go into my own death with that kind of awareness, and that means having no expectations at all. A secular approach, or let's say a skeptical approach to death, would not reject rebirth. It would not affirm that there's nothing after death. We don't know. We really don't have a clue. And to go into this profound mystery with a totally open mind would, to me, be how I would seek, in my own case, to die. Yes. Non-reactivity. This is a Stoic Lama, right? Oh, Yuval Noah Harari. Well, it's good to be moved, and it's good to realize that here we come, I think, to the heart of ethics, basically. The basic question of ethics is, what do I do? What do I do? And unfortunately, life doesn't come to us in black and white. It tends to come in shades of gray. In other words... In other words, when I present this, it all sounds very simple. You know, you encounter a situation, and then there's mindfulness at your gateway, your senses, and lets in the good guys and keeps out the bad guys. Now, that's very crude in a way. That's just to give a kind of an image. In reality, there's good, and it's very difficult sometimes to tell between what is the reactive and what is responsive, what is, you know, negative, what is positive, what should be cultivated, what should be let go of. There's not a kind of a rule book that you can consult and say, oh, well, that's easy. We let go of that one. Oh, that one. Oh, keep that one. It's not. That is very simplistic. It's not like that. The problem with ethics really is that it's enormously challenging because when you have a moral dilemma, when you're really uncertain as to whether I should do A or whether I should do B, you find yourself, you know, vacillating, going back and forth like this, this vichikicca, this doubting that the Buddhists talk about. But at some point, you have to make a choice. You can't wait forever until you've sorted out the answer and then make the choice. In life, if you're in an office, had a meeting, and the meeting ends at 4 o'clock and the group have to make a decision, that you have to do it. You can't say, no, I'm going to go and do a couple of weeks retreat and then I'll come back. No. You have to act on the moment. You have to risk. Ethics is always a risk because we cannot know the outcome. And see, one of the things I find difficult with the doctrine of karma is that it implies quite strongly that certain actions, killing, stealing, lying, and so on, that these are inherently evil or bad. And if you commit them, you will accumulate negative karma that will ripen in some form of suffering later. Now, to me, that doesn't make an awful lot of sense. It fails to take into account the situation under which those acts are committed. An action has a moral value, not in some absolute sense, but only in the context of the situation in which it is enacted. So there may be times when killing is not the worst thing to do. Maybe it's necessary. And then we take this safer to euthanasia. There's so many abortion. All of these moral dilemmas we struggle with in our society today are basically issues on which it is very difficult to impose a right-wrong division. We need to take into account, to my mind, the uniqueness of the human situation in the in that given a case. You know, a woman who is considering an abortion, or a person who's got a terminal disease and is suffering enormously. How do we respond appropriately to that person in that situation? We need to get as good an understanding as possible of their dilemma. And at some point, we will risk a response. And that response may come from deep compassion, but just because it comes from deep compassion doesn't mean it's going to be the right thing to do. That's unfortunately the case. You can do all kinds of things with the greatest of motives and just make things worse. This is obvious, really. And funnily, if you look at the Buddhist texts that actually investigate and go in detail into the doctrine of karma, for example, they acknowledge these complexities. The popular view, good karma, bad karma, is really not even accepted within the more serious theological and philosophical studies you find in Buddhist texts. So, that is the challenge. It's so much easier to have an authority figure, like a priest or a monk, tell us what's right and what's wrong, and then to somehow just present us with a clear-cut morality, what's called a legalistic morality. And again, lots of people will live this way. They won't do certain things because they feel that they are intrinsically going to get them bad karma, and so forth and so on. So I feel we have to go beyond the an ethic of karma and rebirth. I don't think it's helpful anymore at all, frankly. And I think we need to evolve a situational ethic. And we find plenty of texts and teachings in early Buddhism that support this. The Buddha actually rarely speaks in terms of karma producing this result or that result. Sometimes you find him saying that. But he acknowledges that I don't have my text. But to me, the key ethical insight of the Buddha is found in the Sutta Nipata, which is one of the early Pali texts, where it says, just as I am, so are you. Just as you are, so am I. Therefore, I should not kill or cause to kill. In other words, you're killing or not killing. Your relationship to killing has to do with your capacity to empathize with the other person as being just like you. And this is effectively the golden rule. This is do unto others as you would have them do to yourself in the Gospels. And we find this also in Confucianism. This is, to me, is the foundational secular ethic or morality that is quite adequate, I feel, for providing a foundation for a fully lived and engaged ethical life. But it's not easy. It's probably the most difficult kind of ethic because it calls upon you to take responsibility, not a religion or a doctrine or some authority figure. Yeah, of course, that's... And courage. It requires a lot of courage. And I feel that this too is something we cultivate in this meditation. We cultivate a kind of inner strength. A mindfulness is called a strength. It's called a faculty. As are many of the other virtues. That's again something it's worth, you know, thinking about. That we're not just developing virtuous qualities, we're actually refining our own capacity, our own inner strength to have the courage and the willingness to go against public opinion, maybe, to be controversial, to upset people, but to be true to what we most deeply feel to be real.
And from what I can see here, and from my own Buddhist thought, I feel a great thankfulness about the Western Buddhism, because I'm not coming from an academic background, I'm coming from a small city in southern Germany.
That's right.
So it's not so important for me if I believe in karma or not, but it makes me more sensitive. And I think that's a great thing for the rest of the world. We should be proud of that one. And I'm thinking we are this, that secular tradition is opposed to the
religious forms. Twice a year. Well, that's twice more than I like it. But but on the other hand, I spend years doing these deity practices, and I probably got more from them than I'm willing to admit. It's very difficult to know. Anyway, I don't want to go down that track. But yes, I agree with you. I think being in a liberal, open society, a democratic society without an established church, I think allows the emergence of a spiritual or a Buddhist life that is can be enormously enriched. We can be seekers. We can be, and we have this incredible opportunity to have access to all these different forms of Buddhist practice. And I think this is a great richness. I'm glad you brought this up. I would be very uncomfortable if secular Buddhism starts carving itself out as a little privileged special niche that is rejecting all the other forms. That would, to me, be completely going the wrong way. It's about actually working towards a culture of awakening, perhaps, that is open, inclusive, but also critical. I mean, I don't think I think having a critical reflections on these issues is important. I don't think we just accept them because they are ancient or anything like that. But it does allow us to have a relationship with the Dharma that is quite unprecedented. We forget that until about 50 or 60 years ago, every form of Buddhism was largely restricted to a particular geographic place. You have the Tibetan Buddhists in Tibet and the Japanese Buddhists in Japan, and that's all they knew. They had, you know, in Tibet, other forms of Buddhism were illegal. They weren't you weren't allowed. If you were a Chinese Buddhist, you were not allowed in the country. You were barred. And the same is true even today in some Buddhist countries. There's incredible sectarian territorialism going on. Again, often for complicated reasons that are not all stupid. But nonetheless, we don't have to deal with that. We're very fortunate in being free from those kinds of historical commitments and attachments. And that's wonderful. And I think we do need to celebrate the diversity of the Dharma and also to make it our own. And I mean that not just in a broad, vague cultural sense, but for each individual person to make the Dharma his or her own. And again, I think there is, you know, this idea of becoming independent of others in the teaching is very much an encouragement for each practitioner to somehow find from the Dharma and also from other traditions as well, ways of living, ways of practice, ways of thinking that enable him or her to flourish fully as a person in a community. That's what it's all about. To me, the purpose of teaching the Dharma is not to indoctrinate people with my interpretation of Buddhism. I'm much more interested to get people to think for themselves. Thomas was yesterday talking about the European Enlightenment and how much he is a product of that culture. And I feel I am too, and I suspect all of us recognize that at some level. And that does really change the landscape in terms of how we will eventually perhaps come up with some form of Buddhist practice that's not any longer identifiable as Tibetan or Zen or Mahayana or Hinayana or anything like that. Thank you. Yeah. I think about that. Well, if I were to speak in English, I would say we have to distinguish between Buddhism with a big B, no, sorry, belief with a big B and belief with a small B. Now, you can't say that in German. Glauben, yeah. The problem with belief, I agree with what they said. We cannot function as human beings without adopting a whole range of beliefs. In other words, epistemologically, there are many things that we believe and we hold to be true that we don't actually know whether they're true or not. I believe in evolution by natural selection. But if somebody, if I met somebody who didn't believe in that, there's no way I could convince them. There's no way I could persuade people about that, or let's say about quantum theory. I sort of believe in quantum theory, but I don't know what the hell it is. And there's many, 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 many examples. And so any culture, any society is held together by a kind of what we might call, there is actually a good term, justifiable belief is the philosophical term. In other words, beliefs that you cannot, you don't have certainty that these things are true, but there's enough justifiable evidence within your culture that makes it reasonable to accept those things. So that, if you're going to do it strictly epistemologically, you would have to, acknowledge the fact that I actually don't know that there is evolution or there are the Big Bang or any of those things. But I live in a culture, in a society where that is a justified belief. And also to recognize that it could very likely change over time. So the problem with belief is really when it crystallizes into an absolute certainty, when it becomes a kind of a fanatic conviction. Think of some of these people who are motivated by religious beliefs to blow themselves up as suicide bombers. I mean, those people have a belief, but it's not a working hypothesis. Otherwise, they wouldn't blow themselves up. They're completely certain that if they blow themselves up, they'll go to heaven and live happily ever after. That's a very extreme example, but it's that kind of belief that we don't really need anymore. But yes, it would be a great mistake to then say all beliefs have to be rejected. Well, there's not, secular Buddhism doesn't in itself says nothing about belief, does it? Well, I did write a book called Buddhism Without Beliefs, and I accept that could therefore be accused of that problem. But secular Buddhism or secular Dharma it holds certain beliefs. That is true, and you can't deny that. But then so would, say, becoming a communist entail having beliefs. National societies or belonging to the vegan society would hold beliefs too. You see, I mean, you can't get out of beliefs. It's impossible. But it is important to reflect on how you hold your beliefs. That, to me, is the key. Am I really attached to this belief because it gives me a sense of security, it gives me a sense of identity, it gives me a sense of being special? Then beliefs can be very dangerous. But if we rejected belief altogether, it would be almost impossible to function. Yes? Gratitude. I agree. Well, the way you're using the word gratitude, when you first said the word, I thought one thing, and by the time you got to the end of your reflection, I realized you meant something a bit different. Do you mean gratitude in the sense just to be the sheer gratitude for being alive, for being here at all, to be grateful that you exist? Is that sense, or just a sense of sheer wonder at the fact of the universe's generosity to create beings like us. Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think so. I think it does. And but there's not really a term in early Buddhism that corresponds to that. Not that I can think of. I don't think so. I think it's somehow implied, but we do have to acknowledge that the Buddhism grew up very much in the context of an Indian renunciant religion, in which the world was renunciant. In other words, it's and that often reflects a kind of Entsagen, renunciation. The idea that you renounce the world in order to live a life in which you will practice the Dharma and then you will not get born again. Now, if you don't want to get born again, that doesn't imply that you have enormous gratitude for having been born. I don't quite see how you can square that circle. But if we take renunciation, Entsagen, as I would take it, meaning the renunciation of reactivity, then I think we somehow solve that problem. We're not renouncing the world or life, which is somehow how it's sometimes understood that way. We're actually renouncing a particular way of existing, a particular way of being in the world, not the world itself. That's what's being renounced. I think this is very important. Because then, to me, one of the problems with greed, hatred, delusion, or all of these things that Buddhism is trying to cope with, is that I've used this word, they're anesthetics. One of the things they anesthetize ourselves to is the wonder of being alive. And I think this sense of wonder, this sense of awe, this sense of astonishment at how extraordinary it is to be here, that emerges more and more as you let go of selfishness, of attachment, of fear, of pride. All of these things, these reactive patterns, are effectively closing us off from that deep sense of wonderment. And my experience on retreats, and the first time I really experienced this in depth was when I did a Goenka retreat in 1974. I'd been a Tibetan Buddhist monk. I'd been a Tibetan Buddhist for about 2 years then. I'd just been ordained as a monk. And then I did a 10-day Vipassana retreat with Goenka. And that, for the first time, totally opened me up to a sense of how utterly extraordinary it was to be here at all, to breathe. Each breath, each moment. But there's nothing in the Pali text that somehow celebrate that or even acknowledge it. It's as though the Dharma is concerned with getting, freeing us from those things that prevent our life from fully being alive. And fully being alive, to me, means to acknowledge and be deeply grateful to the gift of life itself. And in many Buddhist cultures, that is a language that doesn't occur very much. It's possible that we're, in a sense, secularizing what in the past we would have said our gratitude for God, to God, grateful to God for having given us life. Spinoza would have then said grateful to nature. For him, God, nature mean the same. And I think at that level, yes, I feel that we can have a deeply religious, in a way, openness to the wonder of life itself. And to me, that's always, not always, but since the Goenka retreat and a couple of other experiences I had at that time, that has been, for me, absolutely central to my practice. Absolutely central. This sense of wonder. Yeah, I think it does in a way. I think it does. Yeah. But the only tradition in Buddhism that I think gets close to this is Zen, frankly. On the one hand, Zen is very sensitized to the beauty of the natural world. You don't find that in India, in any Indian religion, really. In a Zen brush painting of an orchid or a frog, this is so much an expression of wonder at the simplest ordinary things raised to the level of being extraordinary. And I think this whole emphasis on questioning in Zen, of asking these deep sort of questions like, what is this? And just staying with the question. Or just being totally still and silent and open to what is happening. Those practices, I feel, bring one very much, I think, into this kind of sensibility of wonder and astonishment. Let's just go here, and then we'll come back to the other time. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes, and I know this happens often on a meditation retreat, is that you just get to a space where you realize that any words and concepts are just not doing it. And that to me is the beginning of art and the beginning of the imagination and the beginning of finding forms of expression that are not conceptual or linguistic. Music, poetry, painting. Heartful, yes, exactly. Yeah. Art, oh, I see, in that sense, yes. In English, at least, that works. No, that's true. And again, that's one of the reasons I'm very attracted to Zen, is because it's the only Buddhist tradition, really, that values the creative arts, that includes calligraphy or flower arranging as an integral part of Dharma practice. It's not in Indian-based traditions, art is large, if it's to be used at all in Buddhism, it is to be used for devotional purposes. Beautiful tankas and statues, but they're only valued because of their ability to support one's spiritual practice, which is fine. But to me, the art that really wakes me up is art that simply seeks to reveal the sheer weirdness of the world. Yeah. The dance or the dance? The dance. Well, I assume you're talking metaphorically. But I feel that once one, again, finds moments in one's life when these reactive patterns are not running the show, then that, I think, opens you into a flow, which is probably at times like a dance, I would suspect. Because that's what I also feel is the problem with greed, hatred, delusion. It's not that they cause suffering, which they obviously do, but because they actually block us from experiencing what you called a sense of wonder, what an artist would call imagination or creativity. And that we perhaps will need, I feel a great need to somehow bring those values into the discourse of the Dharma itself in a more integrated way. Ah, yes. Mm. And the I mean, I agree with you. I mean, this is a point that comes up again and again and again. And I think it's important not to make this practice just a form of personal gratification, making our own life more livable, as it were. And it is true, clearly, that the global capitalism is run largely on greed. It's largely run on creating endless desires for things we don't really need. The whole advertising industry is built on the insight that whatever we get, we're going to get dissatisfied with. Therefore, we create a window to promote next year's the iPad or the iPhone X1 or whatever it is. And the whole thing is so blatantly obvious what's going on. The advertising people understand it perfectly well, and yet we're all kind of hooked into this system. And so on one level, I think it is important to, in the first instance, really look deeply into how you live your life as an economic being and how much you will make. You know, I mean, I find myself deploring global capitalism and global, you know, climate change and all these things. But I really have to ask myself, how much am I complicit in this? I take aeroplanes, I drive a car, I have fridges, all of these machines. How much would I really be willing to lower my standard of living, really? And that, I think, is the first question we have to ask. If we are at some level, you know, doing precisely the things that are causing the problems, then we have to, in the first instance, really reconsider how we are, our own individual lives. If we haven't done that, I feel that we lack somehow the integrity to then, in a sense, address these larger systemic questions, which I do feel do need to be addressed. But actually, Sylvia said something about this yesterday, which I thought was quite good, really. It's very easy, actually, to get preoccupied with, you know, changing the world, changing governments and economic systems and so on. And that makes us feel maybe better about ourselves. But, you know, if we expect other people to change, we have to embody that change in our own life. That's really important. A few weeks ago, I was in Switzerland and I was teaching it's a long story, but I was working with a bunch of business people. Business executives who are training in a thing called mindfulness-based strategic awareness training, which has to do with how to operate in a business setting from a mindfulness perspective. And I was very impressed with these people. They didn't underestimate the difficulties of bringing these kinds of ideas and values into the corporate world. But they themselves are committed to do it. They are being trained to run mindfulness programs in corporations. And the person who set this up, a friend of mine called Juan Humberto Young, who used to be the president of the UBS Bank, so high-flying, financier. He insists that if we can't get these ideas into high-level businesses, there's very little hope that the economic system itself can be somehow directed to a different course. But the people I was working with had no illusions that this would be easy to do. But you have to start somewhere. You have to start with small steps. I struggle with these same questions myself as you. But I don't have any simple solutions. I don't think there are simple solutions. And I despair sometimes when I see, for example, what's going on in America now with the government, which is basically they're just, you know, in some senses, Donald Trump is just being honest. Other governments will, you know, will sort of cover over what they do with, you know, nice sounding idealism. But, you know, he just says, tells it as it is. Yeah, we can't punish the Saudi Arabians. They murder people, but we've got so many millions of jobs dependent on it, we can't really do anything. And people go, how awful, how immoral. But he's actually just being truthful. And I don't like hearing the truth from Donald Trump, but but there you go, you know. It's not, it doesn't give great hope. On that cheerful note, maybe we could just spend... Or is there anything else anyone would like to raise before we... On a more positive note, okay, John. Yeah. Yeah, we're not all as fluent in English as you are, John. Or slow down your English. Same effect. No, it's a good example. I agree, and it reminds me of something I heard from many Tibetans. When you see, I lived in Dharamsala when the Tibetans had only left Tibet 12 years before. Right? They'd only just come out of Tibet. They had had no exposure at all to the modern world. They effectively could have walked out of the 13th century, crossed the Himalayas, and walked into modernity. Now, that's basically what happened. And one of the things that the Tibetans were totally nonplussed, in other words, they just couldn't figure out, was aeroplanes. How could this great big metal object fly in the sky? And They're not stupid people. They're not sort of, you know, coming out of the jungle. They're highly educated men, mainly men. And they realize that obviously these Western people know something we don't know. And that actually really caused them to stop and think. Because in their culture, they were quite convinced that everything that needed to be worth, everything that was worth knowing, they knew. You didn't have to learn... Nothing more had to be explained. They lived in a hermetic world where everything made total sense. And it was a perfect, complete human culture. Aeroplanes kind of blew a hole in their world. and of course many other things too. But aeroplanes, you know, cars you can sort of deal with, like sort of horse and carriage without the horse, but aeroplanes? And so yes, of course, that my not knowing anything about quantum mechanics is different from my not knowing anything about karma, because quantum mechanics has what scientists call explanatory power. Karma doesn't. And karma lacks explanatory power because it can explain everything. It's falsifiable. Exactly, yeah. That's right. No, it's impossible. Same with God. You can't disprove God. You can't disprove karma. You can't disprove reinincarnation. There's no debate. You either believe it or you don't. Okay. We've got 5 minutes before seven. Let's just spend the last few minutes quietly, and then we'll go home. Danke sehr für Ihre Aufmerksamkeit und bitte sehr. Und wir fangen wieder an morgen um 8.